Yeah, so I want to introduce Subhadramati. Great pleasure. Yesterday we had a really good start to the retreat. Vajratara ignited and engaged us all. And she gave us a good overview of the three esoteric refuges. And there was one sentence that she said was, our going for refuge as preceptors stimulates the going for refuge in others. In other words, our ordinands. And I think, amongst other things, this highlighted for me what the quality of my communication is. And that Vajratara brought out, the Dakini, the communication of the Dakini. And today, Subhadramati is going to talk about the speech precepts, and that's about the ethical and dynamic quality of communication. So I think it's very fitting for Subhadramati to be giving this talk, because she's someone who's reflected on and explored very deeply the speech precepts. And I'd also like to say a couple of things about how I've witnessed Subhadramati's dark inequalities, yeah, over the... Not that we've known each other for a long time, but over the time we've known each other. There's a warmth and a friendliness and an encouragement in Subhadramati that I've witnessed personally. And something I've witnessed is she's ready to give others the benefit of the doubt. Yeah. There's a sort of generosity of spirit there and an open-mindedness. And I've also witnessed her spirit of pursuit. Yeah. She's not ready, not so easily ready to give up. Yeah. And well, she doesn't give up easily. And I've also seen that she doesn't give up easily, but she also looks for creative solutions to problems or situations, yeah, where there are maybe things to sort out. Yeah. So, yeah, I've really enjoyed witnessing that in you, Subhadramati, and I look forward to your talk.
Thank you. That's very nice, Kaminaji. Thank you. I do feel warmed up by that. So, yeah, really nice to see you all. And hello to everyone who's watching from afar online. It was very, very nice to... Oh, they're all saying hello. I wonder why everyone was suddenly waving. They're all saying hello to you. I thought someone was alerting me to the shrine room was on fire or something. But I realised they were all waving to all of you. And it was very nice to catch a glimpse of everyone at the beginning of the online groups yesterday. Good. So... So I'm going to talk about the speech precepts. And then, you know, there's going to be talks every day that will unfold them in more detail. So I'm going to, I'm going to say something quite general now, and then it will be sort of drilled down more and more as the days go on. So, of course, from Vajratara's talk yesterday, we had the reminder... we all know this, that Bhante talks about the precepts as jewels. And I really, really like that because, again, as Vajratara reminded us, the precepts, following the speech precepts or any of the precepts, it isn't just about what we don't do. Yeah, it isn't just about what we don't do. It's actually, we're creating something. We're creating qualities. In the speech precepts, you know, pearls and amber and opals and silver. So we're creating qualities of those jewels. And as I'm very fond of saying, Bhante has said that the positive precepts are the real precepts. And I think that is because of their scope and the sort of unendingness of the positive precepts. How could you ever come to an end of kindly speech? You could never come to an end of speaking kindly, both in its scope, but also in the new imaginative ways that you might be inspired to let that precept unfold. Yeah. So the positive precepts are the real precepts. And the positive precepts, all our positive precepts, of course, when we recite them, are in terms of purity and purification. And I had a very interesting little interaction with Paramatha the other day. Of course, he's got all these like hidden treasures, actually, of things Bhante said just in passing and so on. So he said, Paramatha said that Bhante was talking about the influence of his teachers, of Bhante's teachers, on our movement. And Dujong Rinpoche, as you may remember, initiated Bhante into the Vajrasattva practice. But what you might not know, and what I didn't know, what Paramatha said, was this was the influence for Bhante framing the positive precepts along the lines of purity. Yeah, so that way it was Bhante's influence by Dujong Rinpoche. So then in terms of purity, so I thought you could start off with thinking about, well, what are they, in what way are they pure? What are they pure? When we practice the speech precepts, or when, if they were fully, if we'd gone beyond practicing them, if they were fully realised, what would we be pure of? And of course, what we'd be pure of is self-clinging, self-interest. That just wouldn't be there anymore. Bhante talks about self-interest in living with kindness. He says it's like a wedge. It's a wedge that obstructs the flow of life. Yeah. So that wedge of self-interest obstructs the flow of life. So what our job is to remove the wedge. You know, it's like the Buddha talking about, I have found the thorn in the heart and plucked it out. It's the same sort of image, really, isn't it? A wedge and a thorn in the heart. More visceral, the thorn in the heart. So that, you know, that is our real, that's really what makes Buddhism Buddhism, isn't it? That's our real job, is to pull this thorn out of our heart, to remove the wedge of self-interest that is that's obstructing the flow of life. And I tell you, it's a heck of a job, actually. It's like I more and more realise this. I was on my I was on a little solitary retreat just before I came here, and I was thinking, actually, it's amazing anybody's ever skillful at all. It really is amazing. Because, like, as soon as you've got this notion of I'm a me, which, remember, is existential, not, I also just want to remind us this, that's an existential matter. It's not even a moral matter yet. It just comes, unless we're already enlightened, it comes with us into this life. So as soon as we've got that, I'm like, of course we're going to defend it. I really was thinking, God, like, poor us, like, of course we're going to defend it. How would we not defend it? We'd be, in a way, mad not to defend it. This isn't, it's actually asking us to do something. In a certain sense, it's mad. It's like, you know, pull out that thorn, you know. It's really, really deep, is what I'm trying to say. That self-interest is really, really deep. Also, it's not our fault. It comes with the territory of being an unenlightened human being. And if we really could remember that, honestly, we'd never be annoyed with anyone who was unskillful towards us again, because we'd think, well, they're only just trying to solve the problem of life, you know, in a bit of a muddled way or whatever. At the same time, you know, it's the cause of all our suffering, obviously, if you're going around with this thorn in our heart, with this wedge of self-interest that we keep inserting between, you know, into the flow of life, you know, obstructing the flow of life, or trying to obstruct it, of course, then that is the cause of all our suffering, and we can, the Buddha's taught as well, that's his great central discovery, isn't it, that we can remove that wedge, we can remove that thorn, and that's what we're trying to do. Or every single thing, bit of practice we're trying to do is trying to do that. So that when we say I purify my speech or mind or our body, that's what we're trying to do. That's what we're saying. We're saying we're practicing in this way in order to not to do the opposite of driving that wedge of self-interest that's obstructing the flow of life. We're actually trying to remove that wedge of self-interest. So that's what we do. That's what we're doing when we're practicing the speech precepts ultimately. And the Buddha's speech, by definition, is free of that. And just to remind us again, I know we know this, but what we call ethical speech, what we call skillful speech or skillful any action, is just the natural activity of a Buddha, of an enlightened being. We call it skillful because we're still having to practice it if we're not enlightened yet, but for an enlightened being, or when we are enlightened, it would just be second nature. There'll be no question of having to practice it anymore. And in terms of speech, well, there's countless examples of this in the canon, aren't there? In a way, it's all skillful speech. That's all we read about is our skillful, maybe I should say communication, because it's not all literal speech. Again and again, we have examples of pure communication. Yeah, pure communication. I mean, hundreds of them. We've got the Kandanya moment, you know, the first moment that somebody else understands the truth of things. So there you have that pure communication. You can imagine the joy of that moment. You've got all the encounters with the Buddha after that. Angulimala, you know, where the Buddha relates to Angulimala, not in terms of the worst thing he's ever done, you know, in terms of who can immediately see the potential in Angulimala, not relate to him out of fear, and that itself has a transformative effect. My favourite one at the moment is the encounter with Pukkasati. Lovely thing is when the Buddha's, one of the occasions when the Buddha teaches the six element practice, the Dhatu Vibhanga Sutta. Very lovely little story. So you've got Pukkasati. He's a wanderer, and he's a follower of the Buddha, but he's never met the Buddha. He's only heard the teachings. Anyway, he's wandering about. He's gone forth and he's looking for shelter for the night, and he gets shelter. I think it's a potter's shed. I can't quite remember. Is it a potter's shed? Potter's shed? Yeah, potter's shed. So he's in there, and then the potter brings someone else along and says, "Oh, look, can this other person share the shed with you?" And Pukkasati says, "Yes." Now, this other person is actually the Buddha, but Pukkasati doesn't know that. And they just start to meditate the whole night together. And I love imagining this. I love imagining that Pukkasati maybe is already feeling that, you know, his meditation's maybe going particularly deep or something, you know. And then in the morning, the Buddha says to Pukkasati, "Who's your teacher?" He says, "The Buddha." He says, "Have you ever met the Buddha?" And he says, "No." He says, "Would you recognise the Buddha?" He says, "No." And the Buddha says, "I've got meditation practice I can teach you." And Pukkasati immediately agrees. And the Buddha starts teaching him the six element practice. And during the course of that, Pukkasati just realises this is the Buddha. And he says, "The Blessed One has come to me." You know, I love that. "The Blessed One has come to me." Imagine in your mind, you were just realizing, actually, it's the Buddha. And then he's embarrassed, you know, because he says, "Oh, I didn't recognize you," and so on. But the Buddha forgives him for that. But I love that as a sort of instance of, well, that's sometimes communicated. The Buddha doesn't say, "Oh, guess what, actually, I'm the Buddha." He doesn't like to say, "But actually, I'm the Buddha." He actually lets Pukkasati discover it through the influence of the teaching, actually. And, you know, Pukkasati sees the Buddha, well, through the Dharma, actually. So anyway, that, I think that's a lovely instance of, like, pure communication, and it's communication that has taken place in the mind, you know, of Pukkasati. His realization has happened in his mind. And then, of course, we've got Pengir, of course, who not only encounters the Buddha in his mind, but the Buddha actually teaches him in, you know, well, by, you know, purely by mind, you know. It's not just that, that Pengir is evoking the Buddha and thinking about him. He's actually receiving a teaching. The Buddha teaches him the way to the beyond, and Pengir goes there. And that is all purely mind communication. So anyway, I thought that would be nice to start with some examples of pure communication. And, of course, we probably, most of the time, aren't at that level. So we have to practice, you know, we have to practice in our communication. But why we're doing that is to move us more towards the communication of an enlightened being. You know, like Bhante talks about, again, as I'm often saying, about the poet and the poem. The poet, their inspiration, writes the poem, we encounter it, and we're raised up, or any work of art, we're raised up a bit more to the level of the artist. And it's the same, the analogy is the same. The Buddha, just out of his overflowing purity, has pure speech. We, by practicing and by acting as if we had those more enlightened qualities, are actually raised up. And as preceptors and preceptors to be, we're really, really lucky because we have the total best form of communication available to us. That's a bit of a clunky way of putting it. But anyway, we get to be in that kuti with someone. And, well, for me, but I'm sure I don't just speak for myself, there is nothing purer than that. It gives us a chance to experience pure communication when we're in that kuti. That's what it feels like, doesn't it? It feels like it's unsullied, it's unequivocally positive in that kuti. So I think that's brilliant, actually, because it gives us a sort of bit of a taste of that, something like really, it's refined, it's positive, it's not about like me as like little me, and so on. It's completely... it's in relationship. Well, communication is always in relationship with someone else who's in touch with, you know, perfect vision probably at that moment, you know. So it's like very, very potent and wonderful that we get that chance in that kuti. I experience it as well in public ordinations as well. Such a privilege to be able to conduct public ordinations. And I don't know, the year just gone, it felt particularly potent, I think, because the whole thing, everything was so stripped back. I was meant to be with Vajratar and others and Kulanandi leading the three-month retreat. Then it all got like, moved online and so on. And, I mean, it was very stressful to organise, to be honest with you, but actually the experience of doing it was so, I mean, that was pure. If anything was ever pure, that was pure, because everything was stripped away and all that was left was ordination. And I felt in touch with that very, 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 very strongly. And then also, I did like two lots of public ordinations in quite quick succession, a bit more than I usually would. First of all, three people and then 10 people. And you know, really it was like a communication, a simultaneous communication exercise with first three, then 10 people all at the same time. It was so intense. And so I was completely transported, actually. I was completely transported. And how amazing to have had that, you know, be given the chance to have that experience of skillful communication. Most of the time, however, it's not like that. But it's good to have that in mind, isn't it? Because that's what we're trying. It's almost like we're trying to live up to that moment of being in the kuti, you could say. And how can we do this? Well, we're going to have to practice probably quite hard if you're anything like me. So I've got a few thoughts, you know, a few, in a way, almost slightly miscellaneous thoughts about speech. And it's always always a bit hard to talk about the precepts without... Well, I'm always worried I'm going to sound like I'm being a bit haranguing or something. But anyway, so I want to say that everything I say, I'm actually saying it to myself. It completely applies to myself. So easy to be unskillful in speech, isn't it? I was on a recent solitary retreat and I just left the London Buddha Centre after 14 years. So I was imagining that this solitary retreat would be, people use that word processing, I never quite know what it means, but anyway, I thought I'd be processing, you know, that time, I better have a solitary. I don't know what I imagined. I probably imagined that I'd be going over all the, like, you know, all the things that happened to me, you know, over that 14 years. But actually, it was the opposite. I was painfully aware of the, probably not all, but at least some that floated to the surface of all the things I'd said that were harsh and careless, all the times I'd been cowardly and left things unsaid, you know, so... There's one particular, you know how you get that on social, there's one particular day and night. It's just like a flood of all, you know, regrets, you know. So all these, anything I say from now on applies to me. So we want to talk about truthful speech, about kindly and beneficial speech, about harmonising speech. And of course, we can follow this up. You know, Bhante said so much about these things in the 10 pillars and living ethically and elsewhere. I want to talk about two aspects of truthful speech. I want to talk about truthful speech as integrated speech. In fact, all the precepts are integrating. In a way, that's what integration is. In a certain sense, it's realizing really fully that our actions have consequences. I always think it's interesting that in Know Your Mind, Bhante calls the unskillful mental events the forces of disintegration, which shows that, you know, by the mirror of that is that skillful mental events are integrating. So I particularly wanted to talk about keeping our word, doing what we say we'll do, because I think that's integration over time. And I just thought that we might reflect that if we say we'll do something and then we don't do it... what's going on? Yeah, if we make a promise, even a vague promise, like, for example, I often say to people, oh, yeah, I'll keep in touch. And then I don't, you know, it's a bit vague, you know. Then what's going on? And I've had a little thought about a term that I myself and I've also heard used, is that sometimes people say, and I'm sure I've said it myself, oh, I overcommitted. Mm-hmm. And I'm not sure about that term. I'll just throw this out as a little challenge, because it sort of still sounds quite good, you know. I overcommitted, like. What if you said, and I think this is more true, I neurotically committed. I think that's nearer the truth. Tell me, you can argue with me. Because I think when I say I'll do something, like, oh, yeah, it's like I get to sound nice at the time, you know, but then when it comes to the bit, when it comes to actually having to do it, I realise, oh, I didn't really exactly mean it, you know. I wasn't able to follow it through. So There's a little sort of challenge for you. You can have discussed that in your group. But I thought if I had to say I neurotically committed instead of I overcommitted, I do think it'd be near the truth, and I think it would like shake me up a bit. Of course, the other thing is, I mean, that's just about ourselves. Not keeping our word like massively affects other people, and it affects us more the more responsibility we take in relation to other people. So as preceptors, if we don't keep our word and follow through, it will affect people. I always remember this. It was a tragic little incident, and, you know, nobody meant any harm, but I was years and years ago, I was staying in a community. I was just visiting a centre. I was staying in a community with some mitras I didn't know, and I was going to be helping in the evolution shop that day, and one of them worked there. And I said, "Are you working today?" She said, "No, it's my day off, and I'm meeting like such and such an order member." And honestly, she was so excited, like the whole day. And she was saying, "Oh yeah, I'm meeting her today, and I'm getting ready." And then later on, I was in the shop, and this person came in really downcast and started working. And I said, "Oh, I thought it was your day off, you know, and you were meeting, you know, your friend, the order member." And she said she was too tired. And, oh, it was so sad. And I remember thinking, I never want to do that. You know, I saw it from the other side. I'm sure it was innocent. The person really was to, we know what it's like to be true. But when I saw that little, the disappointment, you know, how deep it went, actually. Anyway, so it does have an effect on other people. Of course, the person who we really have to be truthful with is ourself. And I'm quite an advocate of regular confession practice. I know that we can all confess, and I'm sure do. We've got opportunities for that. I'm quite an advocate. Again, you can talk about it in your groups. I can just throw things out and you can argue about them and argue with me. But I think if you create a regular occasion for that, it creates a heightened, even ritual situation. And I think, I always remember something an order member said years ago, that I think what this can produce is, I'll give you the example, illustrate it better. He said when he went to his chapter, which did regular confession, there would always be all sorts of stuff he was happy to say. Because even confession, you can get to sound a little bit good. Oh, look how good I am, I'm confessing this, can't you? Well, if you're me, you do, you know. I don't know. But you know that thing you think, then you go, oh, but I'm not going to say that, you know. Yeah, I think protecting that slightly ritual space gives you the... sets that up. Oh, I'm not going to say that. And of course, that's the thing that is the thing to say. You know, that is the pearl, actually. And that's good, isn't it? I had a lovely little aha moment. It was actually in a preceptor's gathering that I used to be part of at the LVC. It was in Damodin's bedroom. I remember Vijay Shree was there, Vandana Jyoti was there, maybe some others of you, and we were talking about confession. And I suddenly had this aha moment, and I thought, oh yeah, in a Buddhist context, confession deepens Shri. That's why we're doing it. It deepens Shri. It's not particularly about unburdening ourselves. It's not about... oh, I don't know all the other things I remember from Catholic confession. It deepens free. And again, I think that ritual context of a regular confession practice and that actually feeling down to the thing you don't want to say, there's all the things you're happy to say, you don't want to say, and saying it. It is painful, isn't it, when your friend just looks at you quite seriously, and maybe something you've even thought was quite little, and you realise, oh God, oh actually that was actual cruelty, you know. And then you think, oh God, a deepened read. That's and then what you have to remember is that's positive, you know. That's positive, and your friends can help you to get to the truth of that. So that is a few thoughts on truthful speech. So maybe think of truthful speech as integrated speech. Now, I'm not going to say very much about kindly speech, a meaningful speech. But I would say that kindly speech, you could say, is the truth with love. And that means you can say even difficult things if you've got that love. And I think in a few talks coming up, we're going to be talking about giving and receiving feedback. So I'm imagining that that will have truth with love in there somehow. And then I thought, well, meaningful, that is helpful speech, is speech with wisdom. And again, I'm not going to say much about meaningful speech, apart from that if you want to have meaningful speech, you have to have a meaningful life. And if you want to have a meaningful life, one of the ways we can do this, and I've already said that on this retreat, is we can have at least have some times when we curtail our addiction to the surface of our minds. You know, we all want to be deep, and then we're all, well, if you like me, we're addicted to the surface of our minds. And usually the simplest but most difficult way, most effective but in a way the one we find most difficult, is to reduce input. So again, I would advocate, if you can, on this retreat, if you can bear to turn off devices and so on, do that, and have some times of doing nothing at all. I know we all love talking to each other and so on, but I think that is interesting, that practice, if you like, of doing nothing at all. And, you know, again, I'm saying this to myself, I think, well, if I can't do it here, like, where am I going to do it? If I can't do that here, where am I going to do it? So for meaningful speech, we have to have a meaningful life, and that means dropping down below our addiction to the surface of our mind. Okay, so harmonising speech, I'm going to say a little bit more about this. The opposite of harmonising speech is divisive speech, of course. In living ethically, here's one to send a shiver down your spine. It did mine anyway. In living ethically, Bhante says, divisive speech is causing our friends and acquaintances to think worse of each other than they did before you spoke. So causing friends and acquaintances to think worse of each other than they did before you spoke. Yeah, I'll give you time to write that down because it's quite a good one, isn't it? and then that's in Living Ethically. And he also says, and again, this could be an interesting one to discuss. He says, if you undermine trust and respect between people, the disharmony you create engulfs you eventually. Yeah? So if you undermine trust and respect between people, the disharmony you create engulfs yourself eventually. I don't know if this translates into other idioms, but in English we have it comes back to bite you. I don't know if that is in other languages as well. But yeah, if you undermine trust, it will come back to bite you. You could always discuss that. On the other hand, well, harmonising speech is obviously the opposite. It's taking a positive delight in unity. So it's got two aspects. That emotional one takes delight in unity, but also is active. It restores harmony and, this is good, raises existing harmony to an even higher level. So that's the opposite. So you see how that's active, can't you? Rana Ghosha says this really nice thing. He says, what you say to people is important, but what you say about them is even more important. So maybe you could just actually, sometimes you think, if you just remember one thing, just remember that, you know. Rana Ghosha's pithy sayings. What you say to people is important, but what you say about them is even more important. Now, when I wrote Not About Being Good, which was about, I don't know, 10 years or something ago now, I wrote about these speech precepts, and I got very excited about this harmonising speech. And I think now, naively, I really did think that this was the one you could practice perfectly. I just thought, yeah, let's really do that. All you have to do is like never say anything bad about him and only say good things. I really did think, oh, I can really do, or we can really do this, you know. And I think, well, I'm glad I had that excitement, and I think possibly a bit naive, because I later learned that Bhante is called, you know, it's not an accident that he has given them in the order they are. They're not always in that order, the speech precepts, because Bhante is called this the highest level of communication. And actually, Ratna Ghosha helped with this, because he says when Bhante is calling it the highest level of communication, he's not just seeing it as a precept, he's also seeing it as a sangrahavastu, so as the means of unifying the sangha. So in that sense, well, in that sense, it's obviously the activity of a bodhisattva, so it's the highest of all and the most subtle of all. So I just want to say a couple of more things about this, because it's the one that always gets us. I mean, I thought I'd just give one little example. I don't mean a personal example, just one more sort of factor. There's loads of things you could say, basically, about harmonising speech. But I was trying to think, well, what activity might we be involved in as preceptors a lot? And well, we're involved in a lot in discussions about people being ready for ordination, aren't we? And that means we're involved in consensual process a lot. In fact, our whole movement's run on consensus, nearly. So we've been exploring this in other contexts, like the president's meeting and so on. So I'm not going to even attempt to sort of try and give you, in, I don't know, I wouldn't be able to like train you in a consensus model or something like that. But I could just say a few things. One thing, I have actually been trained in it myself by Pam Majerny. I hope you're listening, Pam Majerny, because I want to say thank you for that. Pam Majerny came and stayed in a Samaikula community when I was living there. And in 6 months, I made two major contributions, which is one, she completely renovated our living room and like got all the walls replastered. She just took one look at it and said, no, you can't live here, like complete, get the builders in, get all this sorted. So she did all that. That was amazing. And she trained us in a consensus model, which is still used to this day, Padma Dharani. And the thing I remember, you know how you often remember like one little thing when somebody teaches you something? The thing I remember Padma Dharani saying is, if you want a decision made, this is not the quickest and most efficient way of doing it. And that's not why you're doing it. And I thought that was pretty, that you don't do it because you're trying, this is like the most efficient, quickest way of doing things. You do it to build trust. I found that very helpful, actually. So I think the practice, I mean, there's probably loads of things to practice when you're involved in consensus, but I think the main thing to practice is don't break the consensus. Once you've started it, you've got to finish it. And again, I've been involved in all, I've probably been the breaker and I've probably been the broken, if you see what I mean. So it's really, really easy, isn't it, to, you, I don't know, say you're talking about somebody's readiness for ordination, and they're your friend, so you really like them, plus you think they're ready. And actually, nearly everybody else does, but we'd say one person doesn't, or one group of people doesn't, like T. Ratnaloka or somebody, or the local order members, or one group. Very, very easy to break the consensus and to go and say to that person, look, you know, actually, like, I'm fine, like, I really believe in you. It's these, like, baddies over there, you know, that are holding it up, yeah? Very, very, I mean, I've done it, you know, and I've had it done. Very, very easy to do that. Why do we do that? I think it's a bit similar to the thing about making promises that we can't keep. Well, one reason why we do it is we get to look like the nice one, you know, and the friendly one. I think in that situation, again, it isn't the last word on this, do talk about it in your groups. I think in that situation, all you're at liberty to say is, we haven't reached consensus. I think that is that. Yeah, you can tell me if you think that's true. Otherwise, you've broken it. That's what I mean by if you've started it, you have to finish it. If you don't want to do it by consensus, don't do it in a way. But if you've started that, you've got to see it through. Otherwise, you will get the perhaps liking of the person that you've done that to, but you'll have broken trust elsewhere. So I think it takes a sort of inner strength and courage and maybe even knowing what you're... I'm just saying, just realising myself as I'm speaking to you, knowing what you're letting yourself in for. If you do agree to be part of a consensus process, then you think, God, actually, that's quite a big thing I'm agreeing to. Have I got the courage and strength of mind to even do that, you know? I'm talking to myself, as I say. So I think harmonising speech is actually speech with courage. Also, of course, we harmonise in speech is rejoicing and encouraging other people. Interesting, Ratnagosha says, he says encouraging sounds easy. He says people think it's easy, but actually it's difficult. And he says to give courage, we need courage. I thought that was quite interesting. I wanted to think about that myself. He says it's not as easy as it sounds. You can see if you think that's true. I've given you quite a lot of things to talk about. Okay, so last thing. This last bit is the bit I'm most interested in, actually. It's actually very, very slightly outside the remit, but I am sort of joined it in. It's like, what if someone, especially in this area, is unskillful towards us? I shouldn't say what is up if someone is. Like, people are like totally will be. Like all the time, won't they? People totally will be all the time. You might as well face it. It happens all the time. It happened to me yesterday. Because I'm doing the online group, I have to go on my computer. And you know what it's like once you're on it? You know, you see a little something in threads and you can't help. And then I'm like, what? Like, why didn't you talk to me first before you wrote that? You know, like... We've all been there, haven't we? Has anyone not been there? We've all been there, either because either something in the written form or you just hear something somebody said. So people will be unskillful towards us. They will harm us. They will hurt us. That is just going to happen, really. Obviously, we're going to try and, like, we don't want it to happen, and that's what work is. But it will happen, and I love those three levels from the 8-point mind training, you know. So sometimes people will harm us, and it'll be like a total genuine accident, and they won't even know they've done it. And of course, we might think they didn't. We might think they knew it, you know, but maybe they genuinely didn't know they did it. Second level is they mean it, you know. They either mean it malevolently or, you know, they've been, you know, they want to say their bit and they don't really, you know, they're going to speak out, you know. There's a bit more agency, you know, it's not an accident, they mean it. And that's a bit harder for us to bear or to encounter, maybe I shouldn't say bear. And then the third level, and actually, you know, if it hasn't happened to you yet as a preceptor, it probably will, the more people you ordain. Sorry, don't put that on the tape, sorry. No. is the person who hurts you, even harms you, is the person that you have, like, killed yourself for, that you have, like, totally and utterly helped them and, you know, advocated for them all the way and, you know, etc. After all I've done for you is the refrain that one cries at that moment, inwardly and outwardly. So, of course, this is the territory of betrayal. What do we do when someone betrays us, and someone will betray us. That's the first thing. You know, I've come to think that even an enlightened being, if they're a living human being, by the very fact that they would have to die, in a certain sense, would betray us. Life breaks its promise, as Shantideva says to us. Life breaks its promise. We will be betrayed if we're not enlightened. So what we could do, instead of crying after all that I've done for you, instead of, you know, I don't know, you know, you want to find out who did it and why they did it and then punish them for it, if you're me. In some ways, of course, you won't do that overtly, you know. As Maitreya Banda says in his poem, the daily rancors of the mind are clever ways to be unkind. You find a way, well, if you're me, I'll find a clever way to be unkind. And so you'll find the smoking gun as evidence, you know, and you'll find a way. What I could do instead is I could say, aha, like this is an opportunity for insight. Because if I'm feeling betrayed, it's showing me something I've done. And what I think I've done on the occasions of being betrayed is I've pinned my hopes on someone in the wrong sort of way. Yeah? It's a bit like the five ascetics, I think. You know, imagine how they felt when the Buddha left them. They would have felt betrayed, you know? And that's because they've pinned their hopes on the Buddha in the wrong sort of way. They could have pinned their hopes on the Buddha in the right sort of way, in a way, because he was enlightened, but they pinned their hopes on the Buddha in the wrong sort of way. So betrayal is inevitable, actually. If you pin your hopes on somebody in the wrong sort of way, betrayal is inevitable. Even with life itself, if we pin our hopes on life in the wrong sort of way, life will betray us. If we're a Buddha, we can't be betrayed. The simple as that, you know. I hate to tell you, but it is us that have done it. Do you know what I mean? Because a Buddha cannot be betrayed, you know. So you're trying to do the trick. Of course, we're trying not to be the agent of that betrayal. At the same time, if we are betrayed, then we could use it as an opportunity for insight. We could do that. And then if you did do that, if I did do that, you really would see why Shantideva says our enemy is our best friend. You would experience that. You'd be like, oh, brilliant. Like, you know, I'm like, you know, not that you would say, oh, brilliant, I'm now enlightened, you know, but there would be genuine joy. Well, that's what I'm trying to say. It wouldn't just be like, I've made the best of this difficult situation. There would be genuine joy. And you might have had a glimpse of that. I have had glimpses of that now and then where the very person who I've felt betrayal in relation to, when I've seen that, oh, actually, that was me. You know, that was me who did that thing. I falsely pinned my hopes on them, you know, not to say what that did to them as well when I did that. Then there's been freedom. You know, there's been at least a glimpse of the freedom. Mm. And then you think, ah, that's what Shantideva means. Your enemy really is your friend because they've been the occasion of you seeing one's own unenlightenedness, one's own foolishness. So there we are. So that is some thoughts, some fairly miscellaneous thoughts on the speech precepts. In the end, what it boils down to is our communication self-interested? Has it got that wedge, you know? Or is it generous? Is it altruistic? Is it is it in relation to the other? In the end, what it boils down to as well is trying to embody the spirit of the principles of skillful communication until that becomes our nature. And then our communication really will be those jewels, you know, really will be those pearls, you know, that silver, that amber, those opals. Then our communication really will be, you know, the lotus on our kesa, the red lotus of the skillful activity on which the three jewels rests. So, thank you.
Yeah, thank you very much, Subhadramati. I don't think any of us felt harangued that you can relax. Yeah, I think it was a very skillful way, actually, of putting the speech precepts across. And there was the sort of nitty-gritty of, you know, what we're dealing with right through to insight, a way of gaining insight. And I think what touched me deeply was when you said the purity of what happens in the kuti. And that what we're trying to do is to live up to that moment constantly. Yeah, and that really resonates with me quite deeply. So thank you very much indeed. Yeah, yeah.